my sense from talking to Cuban contacts there is that they're very much settled into a wait-and-see stance that after the initial announcement of the beginnings of the normalization process back in December, there was a lot of excitement. But they're used to waiting a long time. There's a little bit of skepticism about exactly how long this process is going to take and how much that is going to trickle down. And that's rightfully so. It has been a long, fought, intense process. So I think that there is an optimistic attitude, but very much a wait and see. But what is certainly true is that there has already been a tremendous growth in U.S. tourism to the island. So just in the first 6 months of this year, there was a 35% increase over the previous year. And that does have an effect on those Cubans, which are not all Cubans, but those Cubans who are involved in some aspect of the tourist economy. So those who are renting rooms in their houses or who have small restaurants or are petty artisans selling directly to tourists. And those are mostly young Cubans. So those Cubans will, I think, feel a much more direct and immediate impact of these kinds of changes than many of the Cubans who are more involved, employed by the state. But remember, this is still the categories of people who can legally go to the island are still very, very restricted.
The wait-and-see attitude you just spoke of, does that wait-and-see include and probably is dominated by whether or not the U.S. embargo will be lifted?
Yes, I mean, this is still the U.S. embargo, even with the openings that have happened since December, is still the most restrictive, the harshest embargo by any country against any country in the world. So it is stricter than those that regulated Burma, Sudan, Iran, North Korea. It continues to be the only country in the world where Americans cannot travel legally unless they're licensed by the U.S. embargo. And this has tremendous impact, not just in things like tourism, but every day your ability to, if a machine breaks and parts are manufactured in the U.S., it can be extremely difficult to get those replacement parts. For example, U.S. companies are reluctant to ship to Cuba because they're not sure about what these regulations mean and the very real threat of some kind of fines levied by the U.S. government should they break the embargo. So it's very much, I think, part of it is historical, is 50 years of various shifts and moves in U.S.-Cuban policy. And part of it is that the U.S. embargo is still very much alive and it's still very, very strict. And that will take a long time, I think, to move. That will, you know, the president has said that that is that has to be an act of Congress. And as we all know, getting Congress to do anything can be a very long and difficult process.
Do the average Cuban see any real difference between Fidel Castro and Raul Castro?
I think that yes, I believe so. I mean, there are those Cubans, for example, who are protest the regime and see that this is just simply a dynasty, a passage from one to another. But I think the average Cuban who is not politically ideologically opposed to the Castro government do see that Fidel was much more of an ideologue. Raul Castro, when he came to power, was much more unknown. He came out of the military, and it wasn't people were not sure if he was going to be a sort of ideologue in the tradition of his brother. And what he has proven to be has been much more of a pragmatist. He is really opening Cuba much more along the Chinese model, which is maintaining a one-party political system, but opening up a lot of economic possibilities. So, for example, just in the, say, the last 4 or 5 years, Cubans can now do a whole lot of things that they were not previously able to do, particularly around the market. So categories for legal entrepreneurial activity have now increased dramatically. There's over 200. And this is part of the attempt of the Cuban government to get Cubans off the state payroll and into private entrepreneurial practice. So lots of different entrepreneurial categories. Cubans can now buy and sell housing, which was prohibited before. You could only exchange it, which created all kinds of problems if people didn't have a house to exchange. So you can now buy and sell property. You can buy and sell cars, which was also strictly regulated prior to Raul Castro coming into power. So all of these things have really opened up tremendously. But they also, you know, at the same time as they provide much more freedom and much more possibility, they also allow the emergence of much more economic stratification. So those people who can buy a house or buy a car are largely those Cubans who have ties to the remittance economy or to the tourist economy. So it is a mixed blessing. It really is a mixed bag in terms of who benefits from this economic opening.
When President Obama made the announcement on television last week that the diplomatic relations would be restored and that embassies will be opening in Havana and Washington, I understand it was shown live on Cuban television, which is fairly unusual. Is that something that you're seeing more and more, perhaps a little more press freedom?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And this has been that is another thing that Raul has done, has been to say to the press that we cannot move forward unless the people feel like they have a voice and that people in power who are making decisions can hear the everyday complaints of people. So he has actually actively encouraged, particularly the print media, to be critical of the things that they see around them. If they notice institutions or bureaucracies that are not functioning the way that they are supposed to actually report on those. And that is, you know, there's still, I think, a lot of self-censorship after a long tradition of the media really being a voice piece, a mouthpiece for the state. But Raul has actively encouraged the media to be more critical, to be a voice of change, you know, limited change within the socialist view, but still to be a watchdog. And also this this process of the very beginnings of normalization has been done really in tandem. I mean, the initial announcements in December were broadcast virtually simultaneously. So there's been very careful discussion, orchestration that is really unprecedented in the last 50 years of U.S.-Cuban relations. So I think that this, you know, the fact that it was broadcast live represents both an opening of press freedom in Cuba, but also a sense of both parties that they are trying to move to a more open and respectful dialogue, not always agreement, but certainly dialogue.